Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak. As you've probably heard by now, Australia, which is in its summer, is suffering through a horrendous heat wave that is causing wildfires to break out across all six states across the continent. And they've even had to add two new colors, purple and dark pink, to the weather maps to show the temperatures that now exceed 122 degrees Fahrenheit during this, the fiercest heat wave they've had in more than 80 years. And in Tasmania, more than 50,000 acres of forest and farmland, people's homes, have been destroyed. More than 130 fires were blazing across the one state of New South Wales. And strong winds were hampering the efforts to bring the fires under control. So the wind gusts were more than 60 miles per hour. And you surely don't think that couldn't happen here, do you? Then, rather nearby in Antarctica, a study that was just released about 2.5 weeks ago found that West Antarctica is warming almost twice as fast as previously predicted, adding to worries of a thaw that would add to sea level rise from San Francisco to Shanghai and beyond, according to climate scientists at Ohio State University. Annual average temperatures at the Byrd Research Station in West Antarctica had risen 2.4 degrees Celsius, which in our system is 4.3 degrees Fahrenheit, since the 1950s, one of the fastest gains on the planet, and this is three times the global average in climate change. This unexpectedly large increase adds to fears that the ice sheet is vulnerable to thawing. West Antarctica holds enough ice to raise world sea levels by at least 3.3 meters, that's 11 feet, if it ever all melted. And the United Nations panel of climate experts projects that sea levels will rise between 18 to 59 centimeters, that's between 7 to 24 inches this century, and by more if a thaw of Greenland and Antarctica accelerates, which does seem likely, especially since there's so little action on reducing the level of carbon emissions in so many countries, certainly including ours. So this has been the pattern over the past 10 and more years, that the climate scientists take the measurements, put out the projections, which are hair-raising, and then a year and a half or 2 years later say, oh my gosh, it's happening faster than our projections, which then were alarming. So I really don't know why people can go on ignoring it, people in positions of governmental power around the world and certainly corporate power, but that's the situation today. And of course, global climate disruption and all the extreme weather it's bringing is the major issue today, or should be, but it's hardly the only threat to human well-being that we face. My guest today opens her book, Life Rules, with this list of what in the world is going on. Bankrupt local, regional, and national economies, reduced overtaxed public and social services, failing pension plans, banks, lenders, and insurers, degraded and polluted farmland, wetlands, fisheries, and forests, the stark reality of a finite supply of oil, natural gas, and coal, lifestyles, incomes, and jobs dependent on all three fuels, soaring worldwide long-term unemployment, rising costs of living, fluctuating markets and currencies, floundering credit markets, crumbling unsafe infrastructures, and inefficient power grids, insolvent social service, charitable, and disaster relief agencies, increasing shortages of water, minerals, metals, and staple foods, disastrous weather and unpredictable seasons, globe-trotting viruses, invasive species, and ineffective antibiotics, collapsing ecosystems and life-threatening species extinction, mass migration to cities and relatively prosperous economies, rising social, racial, ethnic, religious, and cultural conflict, floundering public education and health systems, inept and corrupt governments, a widening gap between rich and poor. She calls the cumulative effect of all that critical mass, which we've now reached on a planetary level. We'll be hearing today about the dynamics behind that and what can and is being done about it. My guest today is Ellen LaConte. Over the years, she's written articles, essays, and stories for several magazines, including The Sun, East-West Journal, New Perspectives, and Gaia, a literary and environmental journal, as well as for organic gardening magazines, trade journals, and newspapers. In 1980, she interviewed Helen and Scott Nearing, the well-known homesteaders, social critics, and international lecturers, authors of the bestseller Living the Good Life series of books, and also their column that ran in Mother Earth News. She became friends with the Nearings, eventually heading their educational institute called Social Science Institute. And she wrote two memoirs about them entitled On Light Alone and Free Radical, the first of which was translated into Korean, big hit over there. It went through three printings. She's the editor of an online newsletter called Starting Point, which is available through her website, ellenlaconte.com, which is ellenlaconte.com. She lives in the Yadkin River watershed in the Piedmont bioregion of North Carolina. I first heard of Ellen LaConte through some really interesting articles she wrote in recent years for a periodical called Green Horizon. She's with us today because of her important book, Life Rules, which was originally, or you can pronounce it Life Rules, either way, which was originally published by Green Horizon Books in 2010 and was subsequently picked up by New Society Publishers, who brought out a new edition a few months ago. Ellen LaConte, welcome to All Together Now.
I am glad to be together with you, Charlene. This is a great honor for me since I've known your work, these many years, and admired it, and wished I traveled more often to places like California so that I might have studied with you there.
Well, someday we'll meet in person.
I certainly hope so.
Well, let's begin with that list I read, which fills the first page of your book, Life Rules. And this is a radio program about connecting the dots to see the interrelationships. So the first question I want to ask is, why is so much going wrong everywhere at once?
Well, and this is really a relational reality, to refer to the title of your most recent book, which I have also enjoyed and admired. Why so much is going wrong everywhere at once is actually quite simple, although it's not simple for us to deal with or get our heads around. We are living entirely beyond Earth's means of supporting us. And the consequence of that is that systems on which we are depending to support us are being undermined. We are consuming them or despoiling them or changing the way they work to such an extent that they cannot function properly to continue to support us much longer. And this is the first time, as you know, I note in the book, it's the first time in human history, going back 6,000 years, that every human community on the planet is at risk of not being able to support its people.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first time in 11,000 years since the end of the last ice age that every living system, not just human communities, but natural communities, are put at risk by a single global phenomenon of our making. And not since 2 billion years ago since archaic bacteria almost put themselves out of business, and that would have been the end of life on Earth, has a single species, this time us, been the cause of this life-threatening phenomenon, living beyond Earth's means?
Mm-hmm.
As if we had 7 or 10 or 20 or 100 Earths that we could call on to support us, which, of course, we don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, you opened with the phenomenally impressive heat wave and resulting fires, heat wave and after a long period of drought, resulting wildfires in Australia. I just submitted a post to a website today about exactly that, because it indicates we are increasingly hitting a point where the tipping point, the thing that we changed most dramatically first, will be the climate. And that's the one we cannot survive if we push it over the edge.
And yet it seems so hard for people to wrap their minds around it, partly because we have this problematic evolutionary inheritance of growing up with a focus on the local problems, you know, avoiding the snake bites and the saber-toothed tiger, and then local difficulties and solving the local difficulties. And to think on a planetary level just has not been happening very well. And then there's that second problematic tendency, which is we've lived in an industrialized culture now for a couple hundred years, and we're sort of brainwashed into thinking, oh, well, if there's a problem, you know, the next technological fix will take care of it. So
yes.
I noticed that you use a term that would maybe wake up people, this critical mass. We've reached critical mass on a planetary level. And why did you choose that term to use?
Largely because ones that were being used by other authors and in the popular media, for example, tipping point, which applies, and it may in this case with the climate, which applies to a number of critical points in an evolving process. But tipping point, since we have used it so often lately, it indicates actually if you've hit the tipping point, you're already on the other side. And we haven't quite hit the point at which all of the systems on which we depend are broken yet. They are becoming fragile and breaking down, but they haven't quite gone over the equivalent of the fiscal cliff yet. So tipping point, as well as being overused, seem to describe something that you're on the other side of, which we aren't. Collapse is another term that's very popular, and I do occasionally use that. But again, typically you cannot say that something has collapsed until it has actually collapsed. The climate hasn't quite collapsed. Our economy hasn't quite collapsed, although many ecosystems and species have, and many human communities have essentially collapsed. Detroit was certainly pretty close to it, for example. As a totality, the biosphere hasn't collapsed, the climate hasn't collapsed, so that didn't quite cut it for me. It seemed to me that critical mass offered us a term that sort of, it's a point you kind of build up to, and at the point at which you reach it, everything changes. And we are at that building up, in that building up place, with these converging crises that you're describing and others of your guests have talked about. And it also seemed that it would cover, to me, the solution, which is that a critical mass of humans, of us, ordinary humans, actually finally getting our minds around this and taking action would be sufficient to prevent the worst of this global critical mass of crises actually doing us in.
Well, that looks like it's the only thing that's going to do, because, you know, if people remain silent, certainly in this country, the oil and natural gas energies have this death grip on the government in Washington, and the only thing that rattles the people in office in Washington is to be threatened at the polls. So
that's right.
It's numbers turning out and making demands, and also making demands in other ways in between, certainly the elections, like the climate efforts that are coming up. There's a pray-in on Martin Luther King's birthday in front of the White House, and then there's a big event coming up on President's Day that 350.org is sponsoring that they hope will be replicated across the country. So there are ways people can turn out and be counted, because what with our corrupt system, with every vote in Washington skewed in the direction of pleasing the big donors to the campaign coffers, whether they're rich individuals or corporations, we can't get any correct votes for the common good. So it has to be, as you say, pushed by this critical mass standing up and being counted for this.
And ironically, you know, this is a progressive radio show, and you and I and most of the people in your audience will tend to be liberal slash quote-unquote progressive green people who do, to a large extent, have their minds wrapped around this or can wrap their minds around these issues. And I just took myself all the way around the barn and have to find where I was, where the door was when I started what I was about to say. I have a tendency to do that. I get a big thought going and go right around the barn. The irony is people on the other side of this political, other sides of this political equation, Tea Partiers of good intent, who understand that somehow government is not solving problems for us, but aren't necessarily ready to throw out every Latino from the country or, you know, cut everybody off at the knees from social services. There are a lot of conservatives who would understand this proposition that, you know, we need to challenge government, not just shrink it, but challenge it sufficiently that our government learns that we're still the people that they're supposed to serve, and that some of the best ways of doing that, of being served, our being served, are to be given the opportunity to do the healing we need to do in our own communities with guidance from larger sources like government think tanks and sources. But it's not just progressives and greens that need to be involved, and the protests, there must be ways of actually creating an opportunity for Occupy people and Tea Party people and conservatives and progressives to see the central fundamental problem here, which is that the economy that we're participating in and either losing out from, or, well, we won't talk about the beneficiaries because they're not interested in changing anything. They're exactly the folks you were just talking about that are the deep pockets buying government out from under us. The majority of people are not benefiting from the present political and economic system, global and national. And when enough of us realize that that's the case, then we might have something like real storming the, you know, storming the fence, storming the White House, storming the gates, protests.
It's interesting,
like we had with the WTO.
I mean, what you said reminded me that the Tea Party often uses the grandchildren as an arguing point. Like, you don't want to saddle your grandchildren with this huge federal debt, so we have to cut all the social services now. A specious argument, but you
Absolutely.
Could just as easily say, oh, you're worried about the grandchildren. Okay, look what's happening to the state of the life support systems on this planet. They are going to be living on a very different planet with huge hits to what we call, you know, a comfortable way of life on a physical level. So I think, you know, we could take a cue from that, which has seemed to gather so many people in. Well, I think we're clear on the political action that needs to happen, but it's still, I think, hard for people to understand how it got like this. And one of the things I really like about your book, Life Rules or Life Rules, is that you combine this solid eco-social or green analysis, capital G, with your own knowledge from biology. And you bring in, you know, the ways that crises multiply within a complex system or a syndrome. So could you talk about that and the parallels to this sort of runaway global economy that we are all living under?
Yeah, and as you know, was working on this book, I have taken to calling it a viral or pathological economy in order to kind of put it in its place, as it were. There was a period, the analogy that came to my mind through a variety of influences as I was looking at why so much might be going wrong in so many places all at the same time, one of the things I realized, and others have as well, is that we tend to tackle, like you said, locally whether that's locally and in time, immediacy. We tend to tackle the things that are right in front of us. And for most of us, that's putting food on the table, getting to work on time, getting the kids off to school, passing the next exam, whatever. It's those immediate things that are both local and time constrained, time immediate. And we tend, for that reason, because our minds are kind of, have been for a long time, wired to operate that way, we tend not to notice that most crises, most challenges are related to other crises and challenges. And in this case, it seemed to me if I could indicate somehow that it doesn't do any good to tackle just the economic issues or a few of them, or just the environmental issues or a few of them, or just the political issues or a few. All of these are bound up, woven together like the organs in our bodies. If one of them stops working or doesn't work well, then the other system and the other problems are affected. And they multiply so that it's not a 2 times 2 equals 4 issue. It's a 2 times 2 kind of can turn out to equal 20 or 200 after these problems mutually reinforce each other. And the closest analogy, it seemed to me, that I came up, that came to me, to my understanding, is HIV in the human body, a syndrome that most people know of. We know that it's got a single cause, the human immunodeficiency virus, but that virus gets into a body and it affects every system in the body and undermines the ability of every system in the body to take care of itself, provide for itself, and heal itself. It undermines the immune system. Ta-da! Human communities and natural communities on this planet are similar to when they work together and work well and work in harmony with each other, human and natural communities, function as something like an immune system, Earth's immune system. And what's happened is that immune system of human and natural communities has been assailed by the global economy in a way similar to the way HIV assails the human body, so that our ability in our communities, in our towns and cities, and in cooperation or currently not in cooperation with the ecosystems and other species that we live with have been undermined to the extent that we can no longer take care of, defend, make decisions for ourselves, provide for ourselves, so that Earth has, in a way, the equivalent of AIDS or HIV. And unless we deal with the fundamental underlying cause, not the piecemeal causes or the, for example, in AIDS, you can have all kinds of illnesses that come because the immune system is undermined. And for a long time, the medical community tried to treat each of those symptoms, each of those conditions separately. It wasn't until they understood there was one cause they could fix it. So understanding that all of the problems, virtually all of the crises, problems, challenges we're facing now, stem from one fundamental underlying cause, and that is a global economy that's gone viral and is destroying the human and natural communities that actually keep things running on this planet.
And the way that once you see there's one system that everything's related to, you see this multiplication of the symptoms as, again, part of the whole, right? Instead of seeing
the
multiplication as something over on the side that needs to be dealt with separately.
That's right. And if you're, and this is one of the difficulties with actually presuming that governments, national or communities of leaders of governments were actually willing to try to understand these issues and deal with them. It's probably far too complex for any central systems to understand, and we'll get to that, I'm sure, in a minute. These problems probably cannot be solved. They can be facilitated and helped by central governments and from the top down, but they probably can't be solved of a piece by any global organization or single government, or even necessarily any coalition of them. Although deciding to do that could help them acquire the insights they'd need to actually help us to solve these problems.
Well, I think, that in addition to the globalized economy and the new rules which were created when the global agreement on tariffs or trade was renegotiated by the corporate powers in the Bush 1 administration, that the neoliberal ideology so drove that restructuring of the globalized, making possible the globalized economy, and still so many of the elites, the people in power, are trained in that ideology.
Exactly.
So there's this problem of, you know, perspectives that you're schooled in during your formative years are really hard to shake. Humans tend
to stay
in the groove. And so, you know, the most pernicious part among so many of the neoliberal ideology is that the market always knows what's best. And if there's any interference, that's really going to gum it up in ways you can't even imagine. So the market just has to be able to do what it wants now on this planetary scale. And I wonder how you address that level of thinking in addition to the physical globalized economy that's roaring.
Well, it's interesting if you step back far enough, sometimes how simple things actually are to understand, where economies and economists of every stripe have essentially gotten it wrong. And now that we've globalized our economic activity, sort of homogenized and integrated it to the extent that we have, we're really talking about this one economy, even though, you know, we're nations are subsidiaries to that larger economy, we're all really tied to its rules, as you say, the new rules. And the thing that we've missed is that we still think that this economy now is the largest economy on Earth, and it simply isn't. There's one larger, and that's the biosphere. That's
mm-hmm.
life itself.
Mm-hmm.
And every economy of every size, every human economy of every kind and every size on this planet depends on the ecosystem services, the resources, and the healing capacities of the biosphere of life. And if we push life to the brink, if we bankrupt it, life will not come to an end. But the species pushing it to that point may come to an end because life rules against
mm-hmm.
globalized economic activity that overreaches, that exceeds or attempts to exceed Earth's means.
Mm-hmm.
Until we understand that we cannot live without the services and provisions that nature, life, the biosphere, the soils, the oceans, the rivers, until we realize we cannot live without those, but we can live without the monetized global economy, we did all the way up until 60 years ago, and we lived without a fossil-fueled one up until 200 years ago. We can live without those things. We can't live without the food the soils provide, healthy soils, healthy marine fisheries, healthy forests, healthy ecosystems, cleansing the air, producing oxygen, storing carbon dioxide, somehow helping people in leadership to understand that we're not it. We are not larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
Would seem to me to be the message that if we could bear that message up on our shoulders, you know, as we storm those gates and get enough people, a critical mass of Americans and others to understand that, we'd have a message that applies to everybody everywhere.
Well, yeah, that's, I think that this, you know, been the deep work of the ecology movement that we're trained in industrialized cultures to think that the advanced human race lives on top of nature. Nature is
right.
The backdrop for all our jazzy projects. But as the late sage Thomas Berry and also you are saying now, nature is the great economy. You know,
that's
our
right.
economy needs to fit into the great economy
harmonize with.
That is
that's
the
right.
Earth system.
And
so,
that's why my
that's
go
what
ahead,
needs
I'm sorry.
To be achieved. I totally agree.
The mantra would be, or the aim would be, to create life ways that mimic life ways. In Janine Benyus's terms, it would be, you might call it, radical biomimicry.
I want to ask you about that, the radical biomimicry. And we should try to explain to people that you capitalize life when you mean the big planetary system. Life ways, one word, that mimic life's ways. So
that's
a good place to pause, and we'll hear about that after the break. I'm Charlene Spretnak. This is All Together Now, and I'm speaking with my guest, Ellen LaConte.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Ellen LeConte, about her book, Life Rules. Her website address is ellenleconte.com, ellenlaconte.com. And Ellen, the photo on the homepage of your website shows you leaning against the trunk of this glorious, huge tree and a whole grove of them. And I wonder, what kind of trees are those?
They are enormous pine trees. Ironically, where I live here in North Carolina, there is an estate. It's an old suburb, an old Oak Grove suburb, and lovely lawns. And I've got a wildlife habitat certified yard here that I've helped to encourage along over the last decade. And about a mile from my house, there is a 1929 estate that has been turned into a kind of one of these conference center sorts of places. And it's probably 100 acres, just beautiful acres, old trees, but also open fields. It has a very English feel to it. And I take my dog there to walk a lot. And I thought a picture of me small and these glorious, huge pine trees towering over me would indicate something about, what our place is on Earth, that we are the small. And the sad thing is the particular tree that I'm leaning against was old enough and had apparently become weakened on the inside and blew down in a storm last year. So
Well, in the picture, you can see that I can see where it was a pine, but it must die from the bottom up because there are all these marks where the boughs were cut off. And so
next to your tiny form
is this huge trunk that goes all the way up, and then it spreads out to being a pine at the top, which is unusual until you realize it used to be full all the way down.
That's right. And there are several of them. There are a lot of large pines in this neighborhood. It's primarily an oak, maple, hickory, tupelo, ash kind of neighborhood, but there are a lot of beautiful standing old pines here, and I just loved that I love that particular grove at the it's called Graylin. It's the Graylin Conference Center, and I love being there because it does have the combination of an English estate and then some fairly wild areas, and there's a pond where there are a lot of ducks and geese, and it's a lovely place to be able to walk to.
Yeah, so that's in western North Carolina, right?
It's sort of to the Piedmont area, which is not in the Appalachians. It's sort of the stepping down territory.
Oh, I see. Yeah, the Piedmont foothills on the other side.
Yeah,
right, I got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that is kind of close to Thomas Berry's old stomping
ground.
Well,
I knew Thomas Berry. I lunched and met with Thomas a number of times in his last years after I moved here, before he died. And the irony was, he had said he wanted to endorse the book for me, and died about a month before I finished the last draft.
Uh-huh.
So I missed that opportunity.
Well, he's with
to have Thomas' seal of approval. Yes.
Well, so before the break, we were saying that you set as a way people can wrap their minds around and think about that we need to quickly rethink things and design our life ways that match the big capital L life ways. And you use this phrase in the book that life has a steep economic learning curve. So people should be aware of that. What do you mean by that?
Well, and actually, life succeeded in achieving that learning curve, in doing the learning necessary by about 2 billion years ago. If we take it back 4 billion years, the first living life forms on the planet were single-celled archaic bacteria. And in the first 2 billion of the 4 billion years, or approximately 4 billion years, there has been life on Earth. In the first 2 billion, they were all there was. There were a few different kinds, but basically bacteria was the whole story in those first 2 billion years. And in that 2 billion years, they did pretty much exactly what we've done. They created an energy crisis, which they got through, and then a climate crisis, which they got through, and finally a pollution crisis. And in each instance, without any brains, benefit of brains or computers, those archaic single-celled entities, somehow enough of them, a critical mass of them, figured out what they needed to do, or just the successful ones lived and the others didn't, figured out how to survive on a finite planet without putting yourself out of business, either in terms of your energy supply or pollution. We are the result, the sort of top of the food chain result of what they learned, because every living thing is built out of evolved combinations, interrelated, very closely collaborating combinations of single cells. And so the learning curve, life learned, achieved that learning curve 2 billion years ago, and in the 2 billion years since, most of that time, every kind of living thing that has evolved has succeeded, every system has succeeded, to the extent that it did not live beyond the means of its local, regional, and then global environment to support it. And so we can, it's the most successful, longest-lasting economy on the planet. So maybe we take our cues from that rather than from the Chicago school or some other school of people that are completely detached
and
from
pernicious.
The natural
world. Oh, my gosh, the damage the Chicago School of Neoliberal Economics has done. I wonder what you see as being on the other side of this struggle, because you're clearly a visionary. So if we, on the one hand, downsize the destructive system, and you have some ideas on how to do that, then your vision for us is to build up what you call earthological systems. What do you mean by that?
Well, I realized, and actually this came when I was working with my editor at wonderful New Society publishers. They've got a fabulous backlist and present list always of books that are instructive if we decide that we need to take charge of our lives again and how we provide for ourselves and each other. Anyway, when my editor at New Society, we were going through the book and updating and editing, and I realized working with her that economic, I had been using eco-nomic to indicate economic activities and systems that would work with life rather than against life. Mm-hmm. And I realized that even hyphenating or italicizing eco as part of that word still didn't jump the brain over into a new way of thinking.
Right.
And, you know, I talked with her about that, and she said, well, can we come up with another term? And it, again, perfectly logical. You know, we're talking about systems that work with Earth, with life on Earth, earthological, earthonomical systems. So those clearly would not be the same thing as economic systems that are intended entirely to serve humans and mostly a few humans at any one point in time. Mm-hmm. So an earthological or earthonomical community or system or process would be one that always had in mind that largest economy, life working with Earth's, within Earth's means.
Mm-hmm. And what are some examples of what this would look like?
I came up with, because you always need a way to sort of package things so that they can stick in people's minds easily, with what I call life's economic, earthonomic survival protocol, but it is an economic protocol, a sort of 10 commandments of sustainability. And living economies, just to be brief, the 10 steps are in the book, but they are locally self-reliant, regionally interdependent. Mm-hmm. They are non-wasteful, self-organized, self-regulated, very organically democratic. They use inexhaustible sources of energy, primarily solar, but geothermal, wind, and wave would fit. They're equitable common good economies. People don't get left, or species don't get left out of the economies. I mean, obviously not all of them thrive. There is weakness and loss and competition in natural communities. But overwhelmingly, collaboration, cooperation, and self-limitation are encoded in other than human living things. And we can learn from how how those self-limiting factors play out in natural economies so that we can begin to self-limit, but at the same time create richnesses.
Hello? Oh, dear, it sounds like we may have temporarily lost you. So while we're waiting for Ellen to come back, I would like to share some of the examples that she gives in the back of this one community in Colombia, Gaviotas, and she's got this little interview here. Someone went down to study them in Colombia, and she said that they've built a solar kitchen that operates on semi-industrial scale using not imported oil but vegetable oil extracted from cotton seeds, heated in vacuum tubes, and in this community, a school, common buildings, workshops, field hospital, clinic. The idea of what can happen when people actually come together and say, okay, we have to figure this out together here in our community and see what we need to do to achieve food security, what we need to do to achieve energy security. I think that that might come out of the, I'm thinking of the community emergency response trainings in every city. I don't know if you've taken part of those in your neighborhood, but they teach everyone what might need to be done in an emergency, you know, first aid. But they also examine, where the community is sufficient and not. Could it survive over a long-term power outage or blockage of the road so food trucks couldn't come to the grocery store? It's very interesting because that kind of brings them in sync with the tradition towns movement. It's another way in for starting to think about what do we need to look at here? So not only, A, we're ready in case an emergency would make it necessary to live more self-sufficiently for a short term or even a sort of long term, but how might this make the community better right now? So there are various ways converging here to achieve these kinds of model communities that are often held up around the world. So, Ellen, are you back?
I'm back, I guess. I don't know how we got separated, but we did.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and your examples are perfect examples, and that the emergency, one of the things that communities can do fairly quickly using those kinds of technologies and existing organizations, agencies, systems, is to learn, you know, what's available to them, what are their natural and human resources, what are the skills, gifts, abilities of the people in the community, what can they bring to bear on providing for the community if the larger systems are no longer doing that? And it can become a fairly thrilling, the relationships that grow out of people coming together, not worrying so much about what they're going to be paid, but what they can provide and being honored for what their skills, gifts, and abilities and experiences are. Mm-hmm. And with the addition of the increasing and very exciting opportunities to create local money systems and local currencies, mm-hmm. you can free yourself pretty quickly from the larger currency, and these become full employment, full engagement communities, mm-hmm. Which means nobody's left out or left behind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's lots of different versions of the local currencies and sometimes barter credits and mm-hmm. all kinds of different ways it can work. Yeah. Well, I'm would like you to speak about your concept in the book that life is organically democratic.
If you go back to those bacterial economies that finally survived the various critical masses they had created over the first 2 billion years, you find that the way they survived was by ceasing to compete to the death, either for resources or with each other, for any purpose. They began to cooperate, share information, pool intelligence, and in their case it was genetic chemical intelligence and information, and to work together and to actually live together, to create communities of different kinds of bacteria and self-organize systems like coral reefs, for example, where different species work together within one system with what's available to them locally where they are. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, everybody benefits. The mutual benefit for cooperation, for cooperative relationships. And that really is the core of democracy. It's about the word is about people, but it's really about working together to create a common good economy, which is what natural economies for the most part are.
Mm-hmm. And then when you end up saying that it's possible for us to mimic life's politics, that was an interesting concept, yes. Too.
Yes, well, living systems, for example, have no single leader like we tend to. They have leadership that's distributed according to the task at hand, kind of rotating, or what can be called a primus inter pares, first among equals. You different leaders for different purposes. We sort of do that, but then we tend to also focus a lot of power in a very few people, which doesn't happen in natural communities. There are different kinds of leadership required, and every species meets one of those kinds of leadership needs. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but organic democracy, the organizing of community, organizing of political and economic life from the ground up, and evolving, letting that evolve. We lock in systems like we now, you know, like the Constitution is a Bible. Systems like governments need to be able to evolve, to change as circumstances change. Mm-hmm. And that would be one of the other, benefits of mimicking life's politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's so true, that we look at our Constitution as set in stone, and the people who framed it looked at it as a clockworks mechanism with checks and balances. You know, we have this tradition in this country, as John Adams said, I do politics, this is roughly paraphrased, I do politics so my sons can do business, so my grandsons can make art.
Yes.
And, you know, it was just the idea of get politics set up and then forget about it, you know.
Yes.
We don't have
Which
to think about it. There was an evolutionary
right.
sense of every generation can make this democratic experiment better, can figure out how to make it more deeply, effectively democratic. And that would have been very exciting. We would have been 200 years into that process.
And it would have been very lifelike, you know, to allow those life's rules, those economic rules, those rules of natural systems, tend to stay relatively the same, you know, throughout for the last 2 billion years. But they can be tweaked. They can be messed with. They can be tweaked. They can be creatively adjusted. They can't be broken safely, but they mm-hmm. can be tweaked, and improvements are adopted in living systems. When something new and beneficial is learned, it's adopted. If we were to think of constituting governments as more like that, a more fluid, evolutionary, adaptive process than one that was, as you say, and as we behave, written in stone, we'd have something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true. Well, it's underway in various ways. I feel we're still going to need, it's true, we start at the local and it'll trickle up. We're always going to need a federal level and state level,
yes.
But it can all be infused with a new kind of thinking that brings us in sync with life's ways. So, Ellen LeConte, thank you so much for coming on the program and speaking about your book, Life Rules.
And thank you so much for having me on. You're wonderful to converse with.
Oh, good. Always have a good time here.
Yes, we did.
All right. Let's amble on over to the Arts Corner and see what we have there today. Our poem is one by Mary Oliver. And this one's from an early collection, American Primitive, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1984. This poem is entitled The Honey Tree, by Mary Oliver. And so at last I climbed the honey tree, eight chunks of pure light, ate the bodies of bees that could not get out of my way, ate the dark hair of the leaves, the rippling bark, the heartwood. Such frenzy. But joy does that, I'm told, in the beginning. Later, maybe, I'll come here only sometimes and with a middling hunger. But now I climb like a snake. I clamber like a bear to the nuzzling place, to the light salvaged by the thighs of bees and racked up in the body of the tree. Oh, anyone can see how I love myself at last, how I love the world, climbing by day or night in the wind, in the leaves, kneeling at the secret rip, the cords of my body stretching and singing in the heaven of appetite. And for our song today, we'll hear Ain't No Sunshine, which was composed by Bill Withers in 1971. The version we'll hear is sung as a duet by Buddy Guy and Tracy Chapman, plus their sublime guitar work.
Sunshine when she gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she gone. She's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
Sunshine, sung by Buddy Guy and Tracy Chapman. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespratnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio.
Join me next week when my guest will be Michael Brongard, co-author with William McDonough of Cradle to Cradle. Till then, this is Charlene Spratnak with All Together Now,